This is Wednesday, December 12, 2007. I'm Reginald Carter, and I will be interviewing L.M. Detmer, D-E-T-M-E-R. His nickname is Mac. This will be a phone interview. Mac, could you give me your full name for the transcriber?
Lawrence Carnick Detmer. That's M-C-C-O-R-N-I-C-K.
Okay, thanks, Mac.
Spelled with a double U, not a U.
Okay. Let's start with your background. When and where were you born?
Springfield, Kansas. South Central Kansas. Newton Memorial Hospital.
And what date is your birthday?
8/10/30.
Okay, tell us something about your family, maybe your father and mother's background and their occupations. And
They were both children of farmers. My dad was born to a German second-generation immigrant family. Had five siblings, the sort of smack dab in the middle. That family was not education-oriented. And my dad, he had found high school a challenge. He was not a bad student, but he was just bored. And his song was stop doing things with his hands.
Mm-hmm.
And so he won awards for his shop work. But he wanted to have a dairy farm. And so he started with a small herd. And then this was the Depression. And he got hit with brucellosis. And they had to slaughter his herd. There was no insurance in those days, so he started back at zero. He eventually got into working as a roustabout in the oil fields, and eventually became superintendent for drilling and production. A small corporation out of Dallas for production that was in central western Kansas, Oklahoma Panhandle, and South.
Did the family move out to Texas with him? Did you move out to Texas with him when he was out there?
Well, he did this all from our home in Kansas.
Oh, okay.
And he traveled a great deal. He drove a great deal. This was in the days before cell phones.
Mm-hmm.
So he drove a lot. And this was after he got into the management aspect. He died at an early age. He died at 50. Of his fourth heart attack. My mother was one of six daughters. One died of a tetralogy of below two, but all the rest graduated from college. Her parents believed in education. And, her major was home economics, which wasn't uncommon for women of that age era. And her focus was being a homemaker. She really paid a lot of attention to nutrition and that sort of thing. They didn't, because the family was just such limited means, didn't know if there was any way for me to go to college, and I just wasn't going to go, so I did. And I worked my way through school, which a lot of kids are still doing today. And that's the long and the short of it.
Brothers and sisters?
Don's 9 years my junior, and by the time, and my our sister is 6 years my junior, and by the time they came along, the folks were in a position to give them some support. I don't know how much, but I know they got some support.
Mm-hmm. Now, where did you finish high school?
Lynchburg, Kansas.
Okay, and then you went...
My high school years at Lynchburg. It's a little rural, Swedish community south of Salina.
Okay. And did you go immediately to college?
Right.
Did you go immediately to college after high school?
Yes.
And what college was that?
That was Bethany College. I went there for 2 years. knowledge that I would be transferring to the University of Kansas my junior year, and I did.
What was your career ambitions or major in college?
Well, from the age of 13 or 12, I thought I wanted to be a hospital administrator because my mother had a lot of health problems, surgeries, and that was in the days before we had third-party payer. My father could only get money at 18% interest, and so he frankly spent his lifetime paying off for my mother's health care, but he paid it all. But that was my primary motive, and it was an interesting thread because it was my primary interest in the development of the PA and the NP concepts.
So you graduated college, Kansas, in what year?
53.
What did you do right after college then?
I was trying to get into Navy OCS, and I graduated in January, so I went out back home, and I worked as an orderly in the local Catholic hospital. And this was for purposes of learning about the culture of a patient care unit. And because I already had some social psychology in my undergraduate work. And that was fascinating. And I did that until I got my draft notice from the Army and went to the Army. And that was during the Korean War.
And you were drafted into the Army? And how long did you serve?
And that's why I didn't mind being drafted. You only had to give 2 years instead of three.
2 years. Did you end up in the Korean conflict?
No. They were so desperate for typists, and I was a good typist, and I'd been told not to volunteer for anything, so I didn't. And I finally found out they really were desperate, so I volunteered, and then I even got out of some of my basic training. I became a company clerk.
Okay.
And I was, did that for 1 year at Camp Pickett, Virginia, and then they transferred the whole operation down to Fort Sam. That's where I spent my second year.
Okay, and you had a degree, but you weren't interested in becoming an officer?
I was, but I never was accepted. It was probably just as well in view of my personality.
Right.
My degree was a Bachelor of Science in Administration.
Oh, okay. What did you do? So you spent time as an orderly learning about patient care. Did you eventually then move into an administrative position?
No, I went into the Army.
Oh, in the Army. But after you come out of the Army, what did you do?
After I came out of the Army, I went back to University of Kansas for the Year of Independent Study because I had erroneously thought that only brilliant people went to graduate school.
Oh.
And I knew I wasn't brilliant. And I had probably my most productive year of education that year. I applied to the University of Minnesota for the hospital administration curriculum. And part of my senior year at Kansas was a summer clerkship that I spent over at the University of Kansas Medical Center in the Chief Administrator's Office, and that was an experience. And while I went to the University of Kansas, I worked all of the time and lived in the health service hospital, so I knew a lot about what went on in providing essentially an outpatient service, but we had about 55 beds where we could quarantine students. And we had a staff of about 10 physicians, and they did some minor surgeries there. And that's, in fact, where I first met B.J. Anderson. I don't know if you remember her. She was AMA's associate legal counsel. And I wound up at AMA. She was also supportive of the PA concept.
Okay, so you finished up your independent studies. That was, what, 1954 or so?
Well, I didn't get out of the Army until 55.
Oh, okay.
And so that would have been 55, 56.
Okay.
That was
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Fall, and then we had 1 year of academic work in Minneapolis at that campus, and then we were told to, probably in the first quarter, to identify where we would like to do our administrative residency.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I don't know hospitals nationwide well enough to have a foggiest idea. But since I'd never been to the West Coast, I said my preference would be a city on the West Coast, and my alternative would be a city on the East Coast in a teaching hospital, and my third choice would be the Midwest. And so they recommended that I apply at Hopkins.
Okay.
I did, and I was accepted. And it was there for my administrative residency, and then it was assistant to the president, and then it became administrative assistant.
AMA?
Yeah, I went from Hopkins to AMA. I went from Hopkins to the American Hospital Association.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And I was there for 8 years. And at that time, I was AHA's liaison staff with AOTA and AHA Association colleges. And have to solve because federal money was becoming available.
So you were with the American Hospital Association what years? You said for 8 years?
Yes.
So that would have been 19, what?
Oh, whatever. When I send you that CV, you'll have time to think.
But it was in the late 50s, early 60s?
No, I didn't get there. I didn't get to Chicago until 60.
Oh, okay, 65, okay.
So it was there, I was there from 65, maybe it wasn't 8 years, 65 to 71, because in a portion of that time at AHA, they also appointed me to be their liaison to what was then the new concept of regional medical programs. And so I spent a good portion of 2 years living in Bethesda and traveling around the country with the likes of, not Mike DeBakey, but I saw him because he was chair of that group at the time. He was a fascinating person, as you know. And then, Pellegrino.
Mm-hmm.
Pellegrino. I did site visits with him and people of that character. And we reviewed these grant applications, and then we went out to look at what they were doing and gave, you know, wrote a report and that sort of thing. So that was fascinating. I learned a lot in that.
How did the job with the AMA come about?
In large part because the president of Hopkins Hospital had been the president of the American Hospital Association, and CEO of the American Hospital Association was the former president of the Hopkins Hospital.
Oh, okay.
Ed Crosby. And so it was sort of a, you know, like those things happen.
Mm-hmm. What was your title with the AHA, and then what was it with the AMA when you went to work with them?
Well, I was assistant director of, I don't remember, something like the Department of And my boss was a very bright lady, a lot of experience. And so I learned a lot there. And we had councils that were made up of experienced administrators, clinicians, etc. And they helped formulate AHA policy.
When did you first learn about PAs, and how did your job come about getting involved with them, with the Joint Review Committee?
Well, I first learned about them by reading the journals. My focus was manpower issues, and so I read all of the articles that came by our way, because we had a clipping service that sent us all of that information. Then I went to the first PA conference that was held in Duke. I was still on AHA staff at that time. And I still was watching both the PA concept and the NP concept. The NP concept made a lot of sense to me because we never did reward nursing for their interest in clinical care.
Mm-hmm.
In order for them to advance themselves economically, they had to go into nursing service administration. And there were a lot of those women would now be physicians.
Right.
And their sisters have subsequently become physicians. The thing I found attractive about PAs was NP supervision, and I have long felt that all clinicians ought to work under somebody's supervision, because someone's all-knowing. You know that concept has been promoted in the culture of medicine, in large part because of the negative dimension of the model of health staff training. They just don't know what. And that's an overstatement, granted, but they weren't always able to be honest with the people who were conducting the round.
Mm-hmm.
And that was another fascinating insight I developed.
So you were with the American Hospital Association. You've been reading about health manpower issues, PAs, MPs. You came to Duke with that conference.
Right.
And were you sent here for any particular reason, or?
No, just to see what was going on.
Okay. And then out of that, eventually you got to the AMA, and the AMA, at the time you joined them, had they started working on the accreditation guidelines?
Yes, they had. Ralph Cooley recruited me because AMA got a contract from, I think it was, I know it was NIH, and I think it was by then. For want of better terms, I'll call it the Bureau of Health Manpower. And we got a contract to accredit 55 programs by the end of June, and I was recruited the end of May.
Same year?
Yep, same year. There weren't 55 programs in existence.
Right.
But we evaluated every program that was in existence, and as I remember, in the, you know, somewhere in the 30s or very low 40s, if that much. And so they couldn't ask us to do programs that weren't there. I spent probably, 10, 11 hour days. That was before people understood what the concept of primary care was.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can get people online that were recommended by these collaborating sponsors, and maybe I should comment about that. The initial collaborating sponsors, and this is where I think AMA's Council on Health Manpower and Council on Medical Education, they decided since it wanted to be accreditation, it would shift from manpower into the CME.
Mm-hmm.
And each of the organizations who were involved in the development of these standards appointed representatives to serve on this review committee. And those organizations, if my recall is correct, and I think it is, were the American College of Physicians, the American Society of Internal Medicine. ASIM had really taken a heavy role of leadership in that, in my recall. And they subsequently withdrew later on, deciding that there's so much overlap in the membership of ACP and there was no need for each of them to support it. American Academy of Pediatrics, and I think the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons was involved initially, and then dropped out. But the concept was called the Assistant to the Primary Care Physician.
Right.
And they didn't make a segue from that to PA until several years later.
So basically, the people on the council became the representatives to the Joint Review Committee?
No, these were different people.
Oh, different people, okay. How organized was the JRC when you got there? Was there any organization, any process talked about how to go out and accredit?
I think they were going to use the residency model.
Mm-hmm.
And NIH knew what kind of data they wanted to come in on this.
Oh, okay.
And they worked with them. So I wasn't involved in that collaborative work, but my job was to come in and to make it work.
Mm-hmm.
I can't recall if the American Academy of Family Physicians, I think it had a different name at that time.
It was probably general practice or something. That
probably. Mm-hmm. But they were there from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And College of Surgeons was not. And then when they decided that a surgeon's assistant curriculum could be modified to prepare a generic PA, and the SA programs would introduce courses and supervised clinical experience that would give them sufficient primary care experience, than a BS training.
Now, you had to organize site visits and all that. What were the people to site? How did you come up with site visitors?
Largely by asking these organizations to name people who were strong as clinicians and who were recognized in get people from the programs involved.
Mm-hmm.
And so we started inviting program directors to go on site visits and recognized that the cross-fertilization opportunities were positive.
Mm-hmm.
And so we started incorporating them, and then they finally felt comfortable having PAs, so they invited PAs.
Now when you came,
a couple of years after I was there.
The American Academy existed, but there were other groups as well, and I know the association was just forming, didn't get really up and running till 72 with Alfred Sadler, Tom Pym.
Radar screen at that time, as far as the
Were you, they were petitioning to have a seat on the JRC. Do you remember those years, or that 1 or 2 years when they were basically trying to gain official representation? And
I don't remember the particulars.
Uh-huh.
It took a while before the committee felt comfortable with that.
So actually PAs and PA educators were invited to be site visitors before any formal representation was given.
Correct. And in my recall, that is definitely you know, in those early days, there was quite a bit of stress within the committee. It's certainly not unanimity on whether the programs were over-educating or under-educating. There was, for instance, I can remember Joyce Blashoff, who had great respect for her. She was a bright, competent woman. She was an internist from Rush. Mel was one of the first. Mel recognized health centers for inner city in Chicago. Anyway, she came on representing the College of Physicians. She just couldn't believe that MedX could do it. So how do you deal with that? You're on a site visit team. Let her go out and look and see and smell. And she did. She came home a believer.
Yeah.
And so that's the way we dealt with a lot of those issues. You had to give the program the opportunity to demonstrate that they had what it takes to these people who had valid concerns. And so everybody felt respected, and they changed their minds.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the people who were particularly defensive were the family medicine people. They were very concerned.
And that's who these people were supposed to go work with primarily.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that changed over time.
Mm-hmm.
But initially, some of the early people were very guarded, very, very guarded.
Who were some of the people within and outside the AMA during those early years that you worked with that you really felt were the leaders and the people who were making the changes that needed to be
Still
made?
Not that much. From inside.
Mm-hmm.
You felt that the decision had been made, and so you were given the rope and told to run with it.
Okay.
I'm trying to pull up his name. He's been secretary of the CME for a long time. Paul Guy. And I may think of nice guy, he was sort of oriented towards teaching people to do things the old way, told them, rather than let them do.
Mm-hmm.
And I had been brought up in my administrative experience to get people to do, that's the way to get them to learn. But we couldn't use that model until after we had done some site visit training. I managed to manage the contract so that we never expended our money allotted for conducting site visits.
Mm-hmm.
And we were using evaluation teams of 3 and 4 people.
Right.
And they made the decision, they boiled it down to 3, in large part because if you sent 2 out, you'd come at loggerheads on something, but if there was a third person there, you'd get a consensus report.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you really need.
people that were helpful who said basically you were just given the rope and told to make it happen, and it happened. But
behind the scenes, people who were helpful at AMA were two people. Nick Griffin, who was the primary staff person for AMA's Council on Health Manpower, was very supportive, and he was involved in some of the negotiations with NIH. I never was. John Bowser may have been, because I was in John Bowser's department. And the other person was B.J. Anderson, because she was the one who was doing the legal monitoring. Mm-hmm. And she kept an open mind, but she was supportive of the concept.
What's the AMA House of Delegates approved the standards and the mechanism was set up? Was your general view that inside the AMA people were supportive and wanted to see this, I guess at this time, experiment? And
it was a mixed bag.
Uh-huh.
But I was so busy focusing on what I was doing. There were other people who were responsible for that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I didn't really focus on that.
Right.
I didn't feel a need to because it was what support there was strong enough that I didn't think that this, you know, jeopardized. The major question in those days is, this is a good concept, is it going to survive?
Right.
And with every passing year, you had stronger feelings that, yes, it will survive. And I think where it's gone, it's certainly beyond.
Given the different models, MedX, physician assistant, four-year degree models, certificate models, community, college-based programs.
We live in a credentials-oriented culture, and mm-hmm. that was very difficult to counter that.
Yeah.
And we know that the more we process people through higher education, less likely they're going to choose to work in a community of need, city or out in a rural area. It's true. I saw that when I was in Kansas with physicians. They thought that they would let the physicians go out and do their clerkships with rural practitioners, and went out there and they said, I don't want to do this. It didn't work
mm-hmm.
for the days long before the PA concept came along. So, that much attention to the sociology or the anthropology of that.
Did the committee get hung up on any of that in their discussions, or were they very open and just concentrated on the quality of the program? And
they just focused on the quality of the program. They kept their focus.
Okay.
It wasn't their job to do the other thing.
Right. What would you say was the greatest challenge during that time? Did you had adequate funding?
I had adequate funding, yeah. The biggest challenge was finding people who you thought were qualified as licensed.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had money left over. I started to say we had money left over, and so I got NIH to permit us to do some evaluator training.
Mm-hmm.
And we did one, which was a bus to Chicago, which was, unfortunately, myself and another person telling them about how to do a site visit, which was boring and apologizing. And then we revised that so it was an interactive model, and we had workshops in San Francisco and at the homestead in West Virginia.
Were these separate from the annual conference that the Academy put on? Because later I think you
definitely
dovetailed them in with that conference, right?
These were separate. These were under the auspices of the review committee.
Okay.
And New Orleans and Chicago. So Chicago, West Virginia to get the East Coast people, Louisiana to get the people down there, and then California to get the West Coast.
Was the response greater from programs and from academy leadership for people to interview, or was it across the board, a lot of physician administrators interested?
Across the board.
Okay.
I mean, the programs were never reticent.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in those days we had people like Bill Mm-hmm. I want to say Goddard. Tom Goddard.
Yeah, Dawkins.
And I think Carl Fassett was on the committee.
Mm-hmm. How did you see your role and that of the Joint Review Committee change over time?
Well, they really didn't change.
Mm-hmm.
The job was to do the site visits, get them done, and get them processed.
Did the standards go through a couple reviews and edits while you were there?
Oh, yeah. You have to review your standards
mm-hmm.
In order to be recognized as a national accrediting agency by both the U.S. Department of Education and also by the voluntary group, which I forget what it was called then. Now it's called Commission on, I think it's Commission on what the collegiate presidents established to take the place of the earlier ones. And those go through metamorphosis about every 5 years.
Mm-hmm. Now, Cahia, what role was Cahia in all this, and what relationship did you have with them?
I was on the Cahia staff, and as you know, PAs were one of 24 different occupational fields that standards have been established for, and that the Council on Medical Education accredited. Then a lot of the associated health professions thought that CME shouldn't do that. It shouldn't be physician dominated. So AMA created CAHEA. And then there was always a big rub of AMA being involved in physician dominance. And I think AMA reassessed its mission and decided to just get out of it because they were putting a lot of money in it.
Mm-hmm.
And there wasn't much appreciation coming from it. And so they cut loose, and that's when we came independent and moved over to Wacker Drive.
Mm.
And then a lot of the groups fell by the way. AOTA, APTA, X, and I think someone else, but the others went into KF. And then I did that until I retired. They wanted to know if I wanted to renew my contract, and I left is how I did it, and then that was it. And then,
so basically, you
yeah. Before that occurred, John picked up and became the administrator of the review committee, and that I think was before, possibly right at the end of AMA.
So John McCarty got involved.
Yeah.
At that point. And that's when you basically decided not to re-sign your contract and...
No.
Okay.
That had no association with that.
Okay.
Later.
Okay.
I was the administrator of all of the... I was the administratively responsible for coordinating all of these review committees and their activities and all of the national organizations that sponsored the review committees, of which numbered about 72.
Okay.
So it's sort of like a five-ring
circus. Okay, so John took over the administrative part of the review committee, and then you stayed on to do evaluations and those things.
Oh, I got out of that entirely.
Yeah, okay.
Well, there was no point.
Mm-hmm.
I think there really wasn't. The whole thing is mature enough that I didn't have to keep doing that forever.
Mm-hmm. Now, after you left the AMA, did you continue working or go with someone else?
Well, as I said earlier, we went from AMA becoming an independent accrediting agency for allied health
mm-hmm.
when AMA cut the cord. And so we moved across the Chicago River, and we continued doing what AMA had done, but only under our independent we had been reduced
uh-huh.
to by having APTA, AOTA, MedTechs, all by the way.
Mm-hmm.
So we wound up with 18 different occupational fields within the KHEP.
KHEP. Now, were you the executive director of KHEP, or?
Yes.
Okay. And you kept that position until what year?
I'd have to figure it out.
Okay. Well, we can get...
8 years ago.
We can edit that. Okay, what is your current work status? Are you retired now, Mac?
I'm retired.
Okay. Let's reflect back over 40 years of PA education accreditation. What do you feel some of the greatest challenges are for PAs today and what they're facing in the near future?
I can't say I'm close enough to really address that knowledgeably. I think to do that, you have to be very close. I think one of the opportunities, certainly, we see is they're taking over for a lot of the work that house staff has done over the years.
Right.
There's a rubric of necessary basic education, which was a stretch. It was just a way of getting cheap labor and not necessarily focused on being that educational.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even know from my experience at Hopkins, it wasn't always very safe because people were so exhausted.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that's been a bone that medical educators have been chewing for a long time.
Right.
So I see that as an opportunity. It will increase cost, but it may decrease it because you'll save errors.
Mm-hmm.
And then certainly a lot of error reduction is coming now because of EDT. And I'm sure more medical centers are becoming peer-based records rather than handwritten records.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think Duke was one of the early ones to do it. Is that correct?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. So I don't know that I should babble on about that.
Well, you certainly were an early player and played an important role. Any reflections on that role and any sense about that?
I would say it was sort of like doing whitewater rafting. You had to be careful who you involved and who you didn't involve.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of this is politics.
Right.
And so that was a very interesting challenge. And I gave it a chance to work.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly didn't work against it.
Right.
By any stretch of the imagination. And I didn't have, Bill Rui is the guy I was trying
Bill
to think
Rui.
Of.
Mm-hmm.
Bill Rui, who was Secretary of the Council on Medical Education, never put any pressure on us about what was happening in the accreditation service.
Okay.
No, there was always someone on the council, on AMA Council on Health Manpower, that was wanted to kill it, and on the CME, but I don't even remember who those people were, and I don't need to.
Mm-hmm. Thinking back over the innovations that were going on in PA education and the people involved in that, it seems to have really found a niche of its own, and I know we've standardized more over the years, but overall I think those people rose to the occasion and to the standards. Do you agree with that?
Well, we never accredited one that didn't meet standards.
Yeah.
I know some people think standards is a degree. I do not.
Right.
No better. But it's so dominant in the culture. And but if you look at a state like North Carolina, that's not like Nevada.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like my home state of Kansas, where you don't have great expanses of land. And so, it could be that the nurse practitioners will take over that space. I don't really care. It's critical.
Right.
I always thought that Henry Silverstein which I, you know, just screamed at you.
Yeah.
And so people say they're scientifically educated, but they don't make their decisions scientifically. They make them politically and socially.
Yeah.
And that's been a given, and why should we expect them to be indifferent? But I think that was the most disappointing part to me, was the was squeezing out the alternative path. Now, I don't know where Yale is, if it's still a certificate program or not.
No, everybody's moved to the baccalaureate, most people to the master's now.
I'm not surprised, and that's okay. They ought to have an option. One of the things I thought was good was that the student had an option.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And,
well, what I'm hearing you say is that local circumstances vary, and it's hard to apply standards and meet healthcare needs.
Model does not fit all.
Mm-hmm.
And I had enough sociology and anthropology to know that it's very difficult to get attention to
right.
college.
Right.
Those fields have brought.
Well, Mac, I appreciate the
social change that gained acceptance, and particularly with the political weight of nursing against them.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that happens where care is being given, and I don't know if it still exists politically. But nursing sold itself down the road when it started attaching everything to a higher degree. No, they don't. We don't have the quality of nursing coming out of what we used to have, and a lot of the people teaching it have limited clinical experience.
Mm-hmm.
And as a consequence, it gets shortchanged, and they have to teach themselves when they're on the floor,
mm-hmm.
or have the people on the floor teach them. But they're full of too much, I don't know.
Yeah.
The impression is a lot of what they're taught isn't that relevant because they haven't had sufficient experience to make it relevant. It's a worship of a credential rather than a product serves.
I think that's something we have to be very sensitive about. Well, listen, I appreciate the time. Is there any parting words of wisdom, or do you feel like you've said enough for the record?
I think I've said enough for the record. I don't call it wisdom, but I certainly have